My name is Diana Newport, and I am a very grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. My home group is Sharpsburg Tuesday night in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And before I go any farther, I want to tell you that I really hope that the man that coached the Titans team a week ago when you lost to Maryland coaches and the same team shows up next Sunday when you play the Steelers. I'd really appreciate that. Because our kicker just has not been well. My son, our older son, had all this Steeler paraphernalia that he wanted us to put all over the car to drive through Tennessee. And I said, somehow, I don't think that's going to be really cool here. I don't want to create any problems before we get started. I want to thank Milton for calling and asking Joe and I to come down here to speak to you. You will hear Joe this evening. What I have to share with you is my story. It is my experience, strength, and hope. If you've never heard an Al-Anon lead before or you don't know anything about Al-Anon, try not to judge on what I have to say. Try to, listen to somebody else or go to some other meetings and do that, because we're all different. We're all unique. We all have our own personalities. I can share with you what happened to me and where I am today in my recovery in Al-Anon. Like the AAs, I do not have a sobriety date, but I have a sanity date, I believe. I came into Al-Anon on February 7th of 1973. And so in a few months, I'll have 29 years in Al-Anon. And it feels sometimes, oh, thank you, thank you. And I am proud of that, because there are so many people that come in and grasp a little bit and leave. And I always think about the fact that not one person yet in Al-Anon has ever said to me, you don't have to come back. You're okay. When I leave a meeting, they'll say to me, you keep coming back, you keep coming back. So I know I belong here, I know I do. And Al-Anon and AA have given Joe and I a whole new way of life, a life that I never would have believed. We had a great drive, Don. I need to thank George and Joan for coming with us. It's something that I don't think I'll ever get used to. It just overwhelms me that friends would give up their weekend and come and spend it with us and drive on. And we had a great time. We stopped in Bristol, Tennessee, was where we had made our first stop on the way down. And my younger son, along with us being real Steeler fanatics, our younger son and I are very big NASCAR fanatics. And Dale Earnhardt was our idol. And I have not watched a NASCAR race since he passed away. But he wanted us to go to the Bristol racetrack and get some pictures, and if we could possibly, get anything that indicated from the racetrack. So we did, and it was hilarious. We got there, and it was too early in the morning. The gift shop wasn't open, so we rode around, and we went to a McDonald's to have coffee. And I went into the ladies' room, and there was a man and woman sitting there having coffee. And when I came back out, the woman said to me, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Pennsylvania." And she says, "I knew it." She says, "Only up there do they grow them so tall." And I thought, okay, She said, I just knew you were too big to be from Tennessee. I just thought. And I said, that's okay. But we had a great time, and we did that, and we've had a great time since we've been here. You're a super warm bunch of people, and you've made us feel so welcome and so warm, and I really like that. I want to thank Ralph for last night. I really enjoyed everything you had to say. And sometimes I get a little bit frightened when I can identify, with some of the things that you had to say and the fear. So I want to tell you what I was like. I want to tell you a little bit about my background. Our program tells us to share our experience, strength, and hope. And my hope is probably the greatest thing that I have to share with you today. I used to think that the only hope there was for the alcoholic. I didn't believe I deserved to have any hope or that it was necessary. I never once thought in all the years of drinking of praying for me, of asking God to show me a guidance, to help me find somewhere. All I ever prayed for was that you fixed him. Just fix him, and life would be okay. And later on in my story, you'll find out that life was not okay after you fixed him. There were times that it was worse, you know. The part of our welcome, not the part that was read, there's another part that we have a welcome in Al-Anon, and there's a line in there that says, without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. And it had become too much for me. I didn't know I was living with an alcoholic. I thought I was just living with a drunk. I had no idea about alcoholism. I had no idea about the disease of alcoholism. I had no idea that my husband at this point in time didn't have a choice of stopping, that it was just too bad. But I knew that I couldn't live with him anymore, and I knew that the answer out of that was to get rid of him. After all, I had three children. They weren't his in my eyes. They were mine. And they needed a mother. And at that particular point in time, they probably would have been better off with their father than they would have been with me. So I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I am the next to the last of six children. My mother actually had nine children. Two she lost in infancy, and one she lost. I had a brother that died when he was seven. He was a hemophiliac, and he died. My mother was married twice. Her first husband died when my two older sisters and brothers were real young. They were like three, four, and five, and he died of pneumonia and left her with these three children. And life must have been pretty bad back then for her. I can only go on stories that were related by her, all of which I try not to repeat because I found out my mother, one of her things that she could do real well was lie. And she did pass that on to me. And it really helped during the drinking years, let me tell you. It got so good. I couldn't figure out what was the truth and the lie after a while. I was really confused. And along came my dad. My father was born and raised in Czechoslovakia. Came to the United States when he was 26 years old. Now, the story my mother tells me is that they met in a magistrate's office. My father was translating for someone, and she was translating for someone, and they met. I don't know if this is true or not. I really have no idea. I can't tell you that. I do know, because I lived in this household, that they married out of convenience. At that time, if you married an American citizen, you would become a citizen. And my father wanted to be a citizen. My mother needed a man in the house for these children. And so they married. There was absolutely no demonstrating of love in our household. There was never a pat on the back to say, that's a good report card you brought home. You did the dishes well. You set the table good. You did nothing. My mother did not believe in that. My mother's belief was, I bore you. You're here. You've got clothes on your back and food on the table, and don't ask me for anything more. But I wanted more. I wanted more. I wanted what I would see my girlfriends having in their house, love and concern and a friend, and I didn't have that. When I was 14 years old, my father came home from work. He worked in a steel mill. He came home from work, and he went in the living room to watch television, and he had a massive heart attack and died. my younger brother, my brother's 5 years younger than I, were sitting out in the kitchen and, you know, obviously hysterical. We didn't understand anything that was going on. And my mother walked out into the kitchen and she looked at me and she told me it was my fault. And I thought, well, what did I have to do with his? I was really confused. And I don't know, I really don't know if that was the beginning of or what it was, but I wanted out of there. I wanted out of that house. This had been going on for years. I don't know what the reasons were that my mother decided to blame me for things that happened, you know, light bulbs burning out or, you know, the dinner burn. I don't know what it was, but I got the brunt of it. Now, I used to think that it was because of the fact that I am 5'11". No one else in my family is 5'11". My sisters, see, are those petite people. When I see those tags on clothes in the store today, I want to rip them off. You know, I can't stand it. But that's what they were, these petite people, you know. My mother was short. My father was tall, but my brothers are barely as tall as I am. And I used to think in this sick head of mine that somebody found me somewhere or I belonged to another woman, I don't know what I thought, and brought me home and they dumped me there and nobody wanted me. I really thought that nobody wanted me. Because I watched the love that was given to my younger brother, the attention that was given to him, and I didn't get it. And so inside my mind, I started a campaign to get out of that house. I wanted away from there. I wanted to find someone to love me. I wanted to love somebody. I wanted someone to care for me. And so I started that. Now, I grew up in the 50s, and I have no idea why, but back in the 50s, there weren't many guys taller than 5'11". I mean, I don't know what happened, and I don't know what we've fed them since, but there weren't. I was the last person in line in the gym class. We had these, when I think of these gym suits that we wore, that they were never long enough. I was forever last in pulling these things down and trying to get them to fit, and I hated them. I used to try to get out of gym all the time. I'd ask my mother to write me a note so I didn't have to go, and she wouldn't do it. She'd say, go, go. And I hated it. I was embarrassed because they didn't fit the right way. And clothes, sleeves were never long enough on clothes. It just was horrible. This was horrible. When I found tall clothes, I thought I died and went to heaven. I couldn't believe they actually made it. I thought, whoa, this is living now. I can do this. So I was in high school. I was a senior. And I was going down the hall one day in high school, and coming the opposite way was this guy. And we were laughing about it. Betty was saying yesterday how she could find her husband, because he was above in the crowd, and he could never find her, though, because she was too little. Well, coming down this hallway, above and head above everybody else, was this guy, and I thought, oh, my God, look at that. You know, there's actually someone that's tall. And I honed in on him, let me tell you. He could have had three heads, and someone could have said to me, don't go there, you just don't want to go there. And I'd have said, well, you watch me, you know. And I went there, let me tell you. I was to graduate the following year, and I asked Joseph to take me to my senior prom, and he agreed to do that. Now, he had graduated already. So my mother goes into, she goes to buy me a prom dress. Doesn't take me with her. I didn't need to go. She just went on her own, you know. And she comes back. Now, I was about this wide then, okay? Anyhow, I was about that wide. We'll leave it go at that. And anyhow, she comes home with this pink strapless chiffon dress. Now I said, Ma, do you want to tell me how I'm going to hold that thing up? You know, like, I envisioned dancing with one arm here and the other arm. I could not imagine what was going to hold this dress up. And you'll be fine. And it had a hoop in it, okay? So I practiced for 2 days sitting down so that the hoop didn't, you know, go up in the air. And I kept thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. You couldn't safety pin it to anything, you know, your skin. And I thought, oh, what a mess I'm going to be in. And I just envisioned being out on the dance floor with Joe, and it just going boink, right down off. And you see, I wanted this man. So I was going to do everything possible to make a good impression on him. Everything. Didn't matter to me what he asked me to do or what he wanted me to do. I was going to do it. So Joe comes to pick me up for the prom, for the dance that night. And my husband was working, and he had a brand new 58 black Chevy Impala convertible that I would love to have today. And, oh, God, I was so excited. And I got in it perfectly, hoop and all. I did really well. And off we went to this prom dance. And I thought that I was with this cool dude, see, because everybody else there was dating guys that were in the class with them, same age, 17. But I was with an older man, 19, you know. And inside his tuxedo pocket, he had a flask. And every so often, he'd bring it out, and he'd pour it into the Pepsi or Coke or whatever we were drinking. And he'd offer it to a couple of the guys at the table, but none of them wanted it. They know. And I thought, ha, you're so immature, babies. Look at this. And there was nothing wrong with me, you know, and nor was I sick when I came in here. Now, this went on for the evening, I don't even remember much about the evening, to tell you the truth. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, we're headed home from the prom and the after prom. And this cool dude that I had been with had already emptied the flask and gotten something else. I don't even know where he got it at. And the next thing I knew, he just upchucked all over my pink chiffon dress. And I thought, what am I going to tell my mother? You know, I thought, oh, my God. And he'd think that all these little warning signs, and plus he wanted to find a bar to go to. And I had never entered the door of a bar. I had never seen anybody drink. My dad had come home drunk one time when I was a youngster. He had been at a union meeting, and my mother told him that if he ever come home like that again, he was out the door, and he was taking me with him. And, see, I told you I didn't belong in that family, I'm telling you. And I thought, what need for a bar? But he wanted to find a bar. We couldn't find one. He got mad. He dropped me off at the Haas, and we had somehow cleaned the gun, you know, up. I don't even remember how, but I thought, oh, my gosh, she'll kill me. My higher power was my mother. She truly was my mother. I was terrified of that woman. And I was also, I worked real hard to try to get her love. And I wanted to do whatever good girls did so that she would say, my Diana is a nice girl. And the other thing was, she would never call me Diana. Never. She didn't like that. And my sisters named me, and my sisters are like 20 years older than me, and they said no. And she says no. She says, I won't call her that. She always called me Diane. She refused to call me Diana. And I would just get a charge out of this. I thought it really didn't matter to me. So this was to start off, and I pursued my husband. Now I'll tell you about a little story. While I was dating Joe, he invited me to go to his home for dinner to meet his parents. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is it. This is big time, see, because you didn't do that back in the 50s. You didn't meet the girl or boy's parents till like 2 weeks before the wedding. You didn't do all that stuff. I can't even count how many girls I have fed for my sons to try to get them married. We have torn up more pictures. And if you open an album up, you go, oh God, I got to get rid of that picture out of there, you know. They were always bringing, and I'd do real nice, and I'd set the table real nice, and I just made up my mind, none of this is working. I'm going to stop this. But anyhow, we go to his house, and I was so excited. And I fell in love with my mother-in-law the minute I met her. The minute I met her, I fell in love with her. This woman had an Al-Anon program and never knew she had it. She lived one day at a time. She lived with three drunks. I have no idea whether Joe's dad and brother were alcoholics or not. They drank alcoholically, but that's not up for me to decide that. She just lived and let live, and that was it. And she was also about 2 inches taller than me. And I thought, this is so great. I just love this, you know. And we were friends. We truly were friends. And I miss her. I really wish she were here today. I really do. But she would do things like I would take her grocery shopping, and the woman in the grocery store, towns were small and everybody knew one another, would say to her, hey, Ann, how you doing? And how's Earl? And she'd go, that SOB was drunk all night long and didn't come home. And I'd go, Mom, you know, you don't tell people that. Why do you do that? But she didn't care. It's what he was, and that's what she said. And I never learned that part off of her. I couldn't bring myself to doing that. So Joe and I got married, and we had a typical kind of alcoholic wedding night that I won't take you through. We sure didn't have to worry about those walls being thin, John. I can tell you that night, because, you know. Drunks are such romantics, aren't they? You know, they just love you, and they pawn you, and they're all over you. And then when it's time, they're on the floor sleeping, you know. So, I do love you, Joe. You do know that, don't you? I love you. And started off this, what I thought was going to be this wonderful, lovely marriage. I was going to take care of him, and I was going to iron all his clothes and match his socks up and cook for him every night, and life was going to be great. And it wasn't. Drinking was persisting, and at some point in time, I started to notice that the drinking kind of went from Saturdays to Sundays to Mondays to Tuesdays to Wednesdays, and I'm thinking, something wrong here, you know. Life, this just is not the way life's supposed to be. Promises were being broken. You know, I'll be home for dinner and not coming home. And so I thought, what the alcoholic needed, and I've since learned since it's the last thing they ever need, but I figured what they needed, he needed, was some responsibility. And that, you know, this would make him come home if he had this responsibility. And so I conceived our first child. And we had a beautiful baby boy. And he's named after his dad, Joseph John, and he is his dad, Junior. And nothing changed. And so I got pregnant again. And you'd try it once, you just keep on, you know. And we had Jerry, and he's our middle son. And nothing changed. And I thought, this is really, something's wrong here, so we'll give us one more shot. So I had one more son, and his name is John. And the drinking's getting worse, and I stopped there. I'll let you know that. That was enough. And I didn't understand what was going on. I was doing everything that I thought a good wife and a mother was supposed to be doing. I was doing it. I was home every night. I mean, these little kids' shoes were polished beyond belief. Dinner was fixed beautifully on the table. I would wash them and dress them and fix them really nice before their dad got home. I just didn't understand what was going on. Now, I know today, you know, and I didn't know it back then, that the progression of the disease of alcoholism was affecting me faster than it was Joe. I was going downhill much quicker. I immediately got rid of God. I didn't want anything to do with him. I thought I only used him on occasion. If Joe would stay sober on a Sunday morning, then I'd drag him to church because I want God to see him in case he forgot who he was so that, you know, take care of him. I just, I couldn't understand. I was a good daughter. I was a good daughter-in-law. I was a good mother. Why were you doing this? Why did you give me this drunk? I was very confused by that. I had no more friends. I lived in isolation. I just didn't bother anymore. I just didn't know what to do. My soul, my life, my breathing, sleeping, eating, no matter what, was centered on the alcoholic and where he was and what he was doing and what time he would be home. And if he would call me and say, "What's for dinner? I'll be home tonight." And I'd say, you know, meatloaf. "Great," he said, "I'll be home." And he would come home. And I'd think, it's because he likes meatloaf. So I'd make meatloaf for like 3 or 4 days. But he never came home the other days. And I thought, yeah, something wrong here. Maybe I have to try another tactic. You know, I tried doing everything that everyone in this room that's married to an alcoholic has tried to do. I lied for him. I stole for him. I did everything just so that he would come home. And when he would say to me, "I didn't come home tonight because this morning at breakfast you gave me a chipped coffee cup." I said, "Oh, okay," and threw all the coffee cups out, went out and bought all new coffee cups and brought them in. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. I really had no knowledge of it. The disease of alcoholism, whether they tell you that in literature that it affects one out of every four people, they lie. In our home, it affected 100 people at least. It affected all the kids that our son played ball with because he couldn't concentrate on what he was doing. You know, it affected our neighbors because I withdrew and I wouldn't talk to them. I didn't want anything to do with it. It affected all the people that he worked with because of the alcoholism. It affects so many people that pebble in the pond, one of our books is exactly right. It just goes on and on and on and on, and it affects everybody. And so I didn't know what to do, and I was terrified that Joe would die. He drove. He worked for a bank, and he'll tell you his story tonight, but one of his jobs that he did at this particular time was repossess cars, and I think that, you know, he'd die on the road. He's going to die. And so I wanted to be ready. See, my mother wasn't ready when my dad died. We had utter chaos in our home. And so I wanted to be ready when he died, and I knew he'd be dying. So I tried to look into what you did first if they came, whoever it was that came to the door to tell you that they were dead. And I looked into that. I called Social Security to find out how much money we were going to get if he kicked the bucket. And it wasn't too bad. I thought, oh, you know, all we need to do is to get him to cooperate, and we'll be in good shape here. I went into downtown Pittsburgh, and I purchased myself a black dress and a strand of pearls and nylons. And so I'd be ready, see, because that was one of the things that my mother did. She had to run all over for us to have black dresses. I made sure that outfits for these three boys were always pressed and ready to go. And I could close my eyes and just picture us standing at the casket with my arm around them, crying. I don't know how I was going to do that, but I was going to try, crying. And people coming up to me and telling me how much they loved me and how sorry they were for me, and that's all I wanted. I wanted you to say, "I'll love you and I'll help you and I'll take care of you." I wanted that. If I would tell my mother something that Joe did, and it was very little that I ever told her, she'd say to me, "Well, it's your fault. What did you do wrong? It's your fault." So it was always my fault. Now, Joe wasn't cooperating, and I don't know where, you know, how the insanity, I don't know where my insanity was, but we had down the street from us a small tailor, a cleaner's, and I took the dress down there to be cleaned, and I was about the third time I took it down to be cleaned, and I wish I had half the energy that I had then, I really do. There was no 24-hour cleaners, see, and so I would sit there and I would think, now if I take it down on Friday and he dies on Saturday, I won't have nothing to wear on Sunday. What am I going to do? Now, if I take it on Sunday, they don't work on, or Saturday, they don't work on Sunday. I'd go crazy trying to figure out how to get this dress to the cleaners to get it back when it died. A guy in AA said to me one day, why didn't you just buy another dress? And I said, oh my, I wasn't wasting money on two black dresses. Heavens. The woman started to look at me very strange, and I couldn't understand why I was paying her to clean this dress. And I thought, why are you looking at me that way? And after I was in Al-Anon about a year, I was going through some clothes to get rid of it, and the black dress was one of the things I was getting rid of, and I looked at the sleeve, and hanging from the sleeve was the price tag that I had been taking back and forth to this cleaner's all this time. So my next method to try to make this man understand that what he was doing was wrong was, by this point in time, his tolerance was really low, and he was usually home by 8 o'clock, 8:30 at night. So I would work real hard to get these kids fed and into bed so that I could put my project into action, whatever you wanted to call it. I don't know what you wanted to call it, but this is what I did. And I would go into our living room, and I would just move all the furniture around. It looked like a little tornado entered our living room. So I would put the coffee table in front of the door and put the car. I'd just move everything around. And he would come home and he'd fall over it. And he'd get up and he'd, you know, look at it and turn around and fall over the next piece of furniture and just keep on doing this. And then finally he'd had enough of it and he'd, you know, I'd help him stagger him upstairs and get him into bed, which is another thing of which I never understood why we did, but I'd put him into bed and make sure he was clean. I would undress him, put clean t-shirt, everything on him, make sure he was nice and clean, and then I'd go back downstairs and put everything back where it belonged. And then in the morning, Joe would get up and he'd go downstairs to, you know, get dressed, and I'd be feeding our little one, and he'd go in the living room and he'd come back out, and he'd go in the living room and he'd come back out, and I'd go, I'd say to him, what'd you do, lose your teeth again, you know, or something, and he'd say, I'm going to tell you something, that furniture was not like that last night. And I'd say to him, it most certainly was. I said, do you see what's happening to you in the bar? Do you see what they're doing to you? You don't even know where the furniture's at. I said, come on, get with it here, you know. Now, our Al-Anon book, our One Day at a Time book, describes insanity by doing the same thing for days upon days upon days and expecting a different result but never getting it. And that's where I was. I did this for like about 30 days. And you would think after the first time, I mean, furniture wasn't light back then either, you know, and I have a really bad back today, and I really know why. I kept thinking, you try all these things, you try to do whatever it is, and it never works. And one day our son was, I don't know, maybe he was 9 or 10 years old, the oldest boy, and he came home. He went to a local little Catholic school, and he came home, and I asked him, what are you doing home in the middle of the day? And he said, sister kicked me out. And I said, what? And she said, I'm not allowed back in school till you and daddy come together. Now, my mind just started to race because I thought, you know, the kid will be 21 before I ever get his dad sober to get down to school. And I thought, oh, geez, you know, I said, Joey. So that night, you know, alcoholics always do the opposite. Always do the opposite of what you expect them to do. That night, he was home for dinner. And I said to him, if you have time tomorrow morning, we need to get down to school for Joey. Well, he says, you know, what did you do that he got kicked out of school? And I said, I don't even know what the problem is. I says, but we need to go down to school. Now, I just left it go. Next morning, I got up and I was feeding our two-year-old, getting breakfast ready and that. He comes down in his three-piece suit. I'm sitting there in these scrunchy sweats, rollers in my hair, because I don't think there was curling irons back then. I look like disaster. And he said, come on. I said, where are you going? And he said, down to school. And, you know, there's a description of the families of alcoholics in our book and how that you can tell an alcoholic family by the spouse that lives in it, not by the drinker all the time, but by the spouse. Well, we go down to school that day, and I looked like disaster. I had these sweats on, these rollers in my hair. You know, I was a mess. And we're sitting there, and him in his three-piece suit, shaving, you know, smelling good and everything. And so Joe says to this little nun, things are going to change in our family. And I'm sitting there listening to all this like this is news to me. And he said to her, you see, sister, we've had a little drinking problem in our family. Now, let me tell you this. You already know the answer. That's not fair. Okay? Her eyes went right from Joe to me and looked. And I thought, whoa, no, no, no. And I thought, but I didn't say anything. That's your husband. You don't want to say anything to make him look terrible. So you don't say anything. And when we left and we were on our way home, I said, Tim, why didn't you tell sister it was you that drank? And he said, she didn't ask me. And I thought, okay, you know. And this is what our life was like. Joe was a drinker that wandered. He would be gone for days. On our way down here, we stopped at a grocery store to get some things. And you know, and I see the Budweiser or whatever the things are, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. Had we had lived in the South when Joe was drinking, I mean, I sent him to the store for a loaf of bread and a quarter of milk, and he didn't come home sometimes for 3 days. If there'd have been all that booze in there, he wouldn't have been home for a month. I mean, you know, I thought, oh, Lord, I don't know if, when Ralph described last night about going grocery shopping and drinking a beer at the same time, I thought, that would have been it. He'd always been wanting to go to the store for me then. But one particular time, Joe left and was gone for several days. He didn't come home. And when I told you about my mother's lying and how well it helped me, we lived upstairs of Joe's parents at the time. And this woman never knew Joe was gone. She'd say to me, I wanted to see Joe about something. And I go, you know what, Mom? You just missed him. They called him out to work early, or he was working overtime. And I did this for a week. And finally, I called my brother-in-law who worked with Joe, and I said, have you seen him at work? Is there, you know, I don't know what's going on. And he said, I am. He hasn't been at work at all. And did I need any money? And he'd be up. But he said to me, I really think you need to call the police. He says, there could really be a serious accident. And I thought, who cares? You know, who cares? I just want the body so I can collect the insurance, if that's what it takes. So I did call the police. And this really young rookie cop came to the house, and he needed a picture of Joe. And then he said to me, you know, Mrs. Newport, if we find him, we cannot force him to come home. He's over 21, and now I have no idea how I was managing this crying. I can't even tell you how I was managing it, but I was sitting there, you know, sobbing away and dabbing my eyes, and I'm going, I understand. And under my breath, I thought, who cares? Who cares? Just tell me where his body's at so I can send it to the funeral home We can get on with his burial, my life, and that's it. That was my answer to it. In two more days, Joe called me. And I said, where in God's name are you? He said, I don't know. Do you never know where they are? They don't even know where they're at. You know, when I'd walk in the door, where you been? I don't know. You know, I never asked my kids that because I started to learn when they got old enough to drink. What's the sense of it? They don't even remember where they were. It wasn't church, I can tell you that. And he said to me, I'll come home. And I said, that would be nice. But he said to me, you need to change. And I said, okay, I'll change. Just come home. And that's where I thought I was. Now, just last year of drinking was a violent year. It wasn't very pleasant. And I'm really not going to take you through any of that. But somehow, we found our way to an alcoholic treatment center at our local hospital, at St. Francis Hospital. And there I met a man that saved my life, truly saved my life. His name was Mark Osterman. He has since passed away. And he had 15 years of sobriety. And he saved my life. He taught me how to laugh again. And he encouraged me to go to Al-Anon. And I said, I don't need that. I really don't need that. Just take care of him. I want you to fix him and I'll be fine. So one night he asked, Joe was still drinking, and he asked us to attend a local AA meeting together. And we went. And this was one of those spiritual awakenings that we talked about the other night that occurred in my life. We went to this meeting, and it had this winding staircase, and Joe had been drinking. He wasn't drunk, but he had been drinking, and I'm sitting there thinking, my God, where am I following him now? And up this staircase we went, and there were cobwebs, and at the top of the staircase there was just like one solitary light bulb hanging down. But beyond that light bulb, there was laughter. Laughter like I had never heard in all my life. And I thought, we're going to a room full of drunk. I mean, I assumed they were all drinking, or who would be laughing up there like that? And when we got up there, they embraced me. They put their arms around me. They asked me how I was. And that was the very first time that someone cared. Someone cared enough to find out how I was doing. But I said to them, it's not me, it's him. And they said, we don't care. We love you too. And I thought, oh my God, that didn't make sense to me. I didn't know you. How could you love me? I just didn't understand that. And there that night was a woman in Al-Anon. And so I spent some time talking to Mary, and she asked me to go to a meeting, and I did. And for about 2 years, I was around Al-Anon. And then I came into Al-Anon. And I entered it with both feet in every phase of my body that I could have, because that first year of sobriety was absolutely the most horrible year of my life. I didn't understand this person that I was living with. I didn't understand why all of a sudden he thought he should know how much money was in the checking account. Like, are you nuts? You know, wanted to tell our son what time to be home. He wasn't our son, he was my son, see? And I couldn't handle that. I couldn't handle this change in this person. And I'll tell you, if it wouldn't have been for Al-Anon, I'd have been gone. I would have been gone, because now everything that I had hoped and prayed for was coming about, and I couldn't handle it. And what I learned was that the things that were wrong with me had nothing to do with alcoholism. They were things that I had long before I met the alcoholic, long before I met him. You know, my fears, my insecurities, my lack of... I grew up with such a fearful God that it was absolutely unreal. And so I really listened to you. I really listened. I came to the meetings, and when they tell you that you find someone that you identify with, I was at a meeting, and it was about a year after I was in Al-Anon, and I still was like, you know, floundering, going back and forth. And there was a woman, when I got into the meeting, sitting and talking to another group of people, and she was talking about her husband and how he had passed away, and the flowers, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, wow. And I went over to her, and I said, you know, I really don't know you or know your husband, but you really have my sympathy. And she looked at me, and she said, he ain't dead. This was how she had planned it, and she was sharing it. And I thought, I belong. Oh, do I belong? I belong here, man, more than anything in the world, I thought. And then I could share with you that I had thought that I had done that, because trust was not something I had when I came through these doors of Al-Anon. Who was there to trust? There was no one for me to trust, no one at all. I didn't have anybody. And so I find you. And I am so, so grateful for the people in AA. I didn't like you at first, I will tell you that. I didn't like him going every night of the week to these meetings, okay? Coming home, words of wisdom, like, you already know what they are too, huh? I'd say to him, Joe, gas bill's a little bit late. He'd say to me, you have gas today, Diane? And I'd think, I'll kill him. It's easy does it. You know, I live, and he would do it too. It would do it. I live with a person that easy does it had to been poured inside of him when he was conceived. I don't know. I mean, he's just like, it's, you know, we're leaving at 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning to come down here, and he's packing at 7:30 in the morning. I'm going like, Joe, you know, could you get on with that? Don't worry about it. It'll happen. And it does. That's what frustrates me so bad. And so I started to do those things. I started to take, I loved your reading. I'm so glad you read that description after the steps. I've never heard that before. I learned that I was powerless over alcohol. Didn't matter whether he was drinking or not. I was powerless over alcohol. And we were now living with the ism. And I had to do something about that. I had to create something for me that was going to work out. And it was you. You know, never kicked me out of an AA meeting when I went into it. The guy that was Joe's first sponsor would listen to me no matter when I called him. I had to get a sponsor. My first sponsor didn't work out too well. And it took me a long time after that. She apparently had never learned the word trust. And there were too many things that I was telling her that she was telling her husband. And yeah, it created a little bit of havoc in my life, and I can tell you that. And so I next time I listened, and I made sure I knew who I was talking to before I asked them again to be my sponsor. You know, I took that third step. And today, I have a higher power that is mine, that I don't choose to share. He is mine. And I can talk to him any way I want. I can yell at him when I feel like it. I can tell him, you know, this isn't what I wanted out of life. What are you doing to me here? Come on now, you know. And he never shuts that door on me. You know, it's okay. You just keep coming back, Diane. You just keep coming back, and I have. Now, I want to tell you about these three sons of ours for a while. This 5'11" height that I hated so darn much has appeared in these boys who are 6'3", 6'5", and 6'8". And they are the love of my life. They are 40, 36, and 33. And God found it fit to have a really good sense of humor and decide to give me another alcoholic in my life. And it's our 40-year-old. And when we were talking the other night, you know, had that little discussion, I shared, I had a lot of guilt over that, because I wasn't a good mother to that child. I was not a good mother to that child. And one of my greatest rewards was, he is the father of the only two grandchildren we have right now. Waited a long time to have these. They're just two and one. But when that two-year-old was born, to have that baby put in our arms, and to ask me to watch that baby, so his wife could go back to work because he had lost his job. I said, you want me to watch Timmy? You want me to watch him? You trust me? I mean, I wasn't a good mother. And he's the one that ridded me of all my guilt so long ago by saying, it wasn't your fault. You did what you had to do. So I would watch Timmy, and he would bring Timmy over in the morning, and I would give Timmy his morning bottle, and he would be, you know, 8 weeks old. And one day my husband came in and heard me doing this, and I'd say to him, Timmy, I'd tell him his prayers, and I'd say, your mommy and daddy love you, and I'd go through all that, and then I'd go to him, I'd go, and Timmy, you will not like alcohol when you grow up. Joe came in one day and he heard me and he said, I don't believe that. And I said, I'd go to him, Timmy, it's cocky bad. I'd go like this. And I said, how do you know it won't work, Joe? I mean, you know, how do we know? But he is the love of our life. They have two of them, but Timmy, there will be nobody to ever replace what Timmy is to Joe and I. Joe is his buddy. He's my pep, my buddy. Now, this older boy had this drinking problem, and 3 months ago, he's had a life that, God, if he ever could write a book, we would just all probably fall over. But he did a lot of drugs. He dealt in a lot of drugs in Germany, and it's a miracle that he didn't get caught, or we wouldn't be seeing him today or have these grandchildren. But 3 months ago, he called us on the phone and had some financial problems because of the drinking and said, would it be okay if we moved in with you guys? Now, we don't have a big house, okay? And I said, oh, God. And Joe said to him, you're more than welcome to come in here to live, but there will be no drinking in this household. And so our son enrolled himself into a rehab. And I guess he's got about 2 months now. He seems to really like AA. He's going to a lot of meetings. He got himself a sponsor. I can't convince my daughter-in-law to go to Al-Anon. I'm working on it real hard. I pray for her. I love her a whole lot, but she just doesn't think it's a problem. And there's nothing I can do about that now. But Jerry and I were talking this morning, and I said, I work real hard on the fact of keeping our traditions alive in Al-Anon. They're a very, very important part of my life and a part of my Al-Anon program. And I believe that we need to keep those traditions the way they are, that we need to keep those doors open for the people who have lived with the problem of alcoholism. I do not like, you know, I had a girl at the meeting the other day that was coming to an Al-Anon meeting because her ex-husband's grandfather was an alcoholic. And I thought, ah, child, you know, if you can relate to anything I'm saying, I really want to know what it is because, I want you here because your life has been affected by somebody's drinking. Not because they speed drive down the highway or they're addicted to NASCAR races or to football, but because of someone's drinking. And I think that's where our traditions need to keep us and keep it going so that we keep it alive, so that one day if my daughter-in-law or my grandchildren want to walk through these doors of AA and Al-Anon, we're here. We're here for them to keep those doors open. And I think that's what's important. I love all of you. I have a little thing that I want to read to you. I thank you again for asking us. This has been a really, really special weekend for us, and it came at a really crucial time. As Joe shared the other night, a couple weeks ago, he said, I really don't even know if I want to go. Our life had just become so bizarre with these four other people living in our home that it's like... it just was crazy, and my younger son said to me, you thought with your heart, Mom, and not your head when you said okay, and I said, yeah, I did. We wanted the babies, and we are awaiting the birth of a third grandchild. Our middle son Jerry's wife is due any day, so we're kind of anxious about that. But Joe brought this little poem or little verse home one day. It was in a paper that he got from work, and it said, many people will walk in and out of our life, but only true friends will leave footprints in our hearts. And that's how I feel about all of you. You're all very special. You've made Joe and I feel very welcome this weekend and have had a great time. And I thank you again, and I love every one of you. Thank you.